Reality TV has become more than mindless entertainment. It's now mainstream American culture. If you don't know who won this season's American Idol, you're out of the loop. But what does reality TV tell us about gender and race and class? Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm glad to be with you today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is a journalist and media critic. Jennifer L. Posner is the executive director of Women in Media and News. She's the author of the book Reality Bites Back, The Troubling Truth About Guilty Pleasure TV. And we want to know what you think this hour. Is reality TV empowering to the average person, or is it sending us poisonous messages about what it means to live well? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And you can send your email to talk@WPR.org and also chime in on our Facebook page at The Veronica Rickert Show. And Jennifer Posner, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I think this is going to be fun.
Well, I want to start by just getting a taste of what we're talking about here in case we're not all brushed up on our reality TV. Let's start with one of the seminal reality shows that you say sort of set the tone in a lot of ways. Here is a clip from The Bachelor.
I'm a sweet Southern girl living in New York, and I'm ready for love. I haven't even been single that long, and I don't like it. I'm not good at the dating thing. It's awkward. It's just there's so many games that everybody plays. I'm feeling like, am I ever going to meet that person again? It's very scary.
I need to find a husband.
Finding a boyfriend is kind of like shopping for a great pair of shoes.
Love.
It's really difficult. You got to go through a lot of really ugly, cheap, cheesy ones to find a really great one.
And a clip there from The Bachelor. And Jennifer, what comes to mind when you think about that show?
Well, The Bachelor, you're absolutely right that it set the template for the next decade of reality TV's treatment of women, because even in other shows, competition shows and lifestyle shows, the same tropes about women that we first saw on Who Wants to Marry a Millionaire and its sort of bastard child, The Bachelor, exist in all of those shows. So, for example, the concept that women are desperate, pathetic, needy, and absolutely, no matter what, miserable unless they're chosen by some guy, any guy, even a guy who's kind of a lunkhead who doesn't know them from Adam and is, you know, unfaithful and will snog 15 other women in front of them, but will yell at them if they mention another man. Mm. You know, as well as tropes about women being gold diggers, being stupid, being catty, manipulative, quote-unquote bitchy, and not to be trusted, especially not by other women. So those are the things that we've learned about, quote-unquote, real women in America in the last decade of reality TV, in part because The Bachelor has told us so for all these many seasons.
Do you think people really take The Bachelor for real? I mean, or do they know that this is something that's been set up? It is entertainment, after all. There are producers involved, and they're editing the most juicy parts and leaving those in. Maybe they're inciting the contestants. I mean, do you think anyone still has the illusion that these are real women?
Well, you know, it's a complicated question. It doesn't sound like it is, but when you ask an average person, do you think reality TV is real? Let's say, oh, no, I know it's fake. Oh, that's all, you know, it's just the juicy stuff. But then if you ask them, oh, but what did you think about so-and-so on Flavor of Love? Or what did you think about this particular candidate on The Bachelor? They'll start going off with, you know, gusto about, oh, that woman is such a skank, or that guy is such a douchebag, or this person's so stupid. Or if you think you know anything about a person's real personality based on what you've seen on a reality show, you have absolutely no idea that the shows aren't real. Most people understand that they're edited. They don't understand, but the absolute depth of manipulation in the editing process and the production process and the writing process of reality shows are hidden from viewers. So it's not that viewers are stupid. It's that the genre itself has some very key lies that it rests on, one of which is that they're just reflecting who we are at any given moment. They're just editing down to the most juicy bits. That's not actually true. There's a process called Frankenbite editing, And that is so first of all, the fact that editors had to come up with a name for their manipulation, because it's so common, I think is telling. But there's this term called frankenbiting, which means the way that they'll take little bits of a piece of a conversation you might have had, say, on a Monday with one person, and then another conversation with a different person, maybe your mom on the phone on Wednesday, and yet a third conversation with, say, somebody you want to date or somebody you want a job interview from on a Friday, edit all the key snippets of that conversation together, run the results as in voiceover narration while you're pictured on screen doing something entirely different with a fourth person. And that's not the juicy bits. That's not anything.
Right.
That's a total fiction.
Yeah, in journalism, we'd call that something else.
We'd
call that lying.
We'd call it something else in documentary, too.
We'd
call it manipulation. We'd call it misleading the viewer. The other thing that we would call misleading the viewer in journalism or the reader is the idea that that these people are just going about expressing themselves as opposed to expressing exactly the roles they were cast to play, and often with lines and scenarios fed to them by producers.
So what do you think it is that appeals to us so much about shows like this? If we know, I mean, some part of us usually knows that this is, you know, not exactly the cream of the crop TV that we're watching here. This is stuff that's a little, like you said, it's a guilty pleasure. If that's true, why do so many of us like to watch it?
Well, you know, there are many different reasons why people like to watch. These shows are in many cases funny. At the very least, it's gallows humor. There are a lot of different shows, too, and a lot of different subgenres of shows. So each subgenre speaks to a different element or a different sort of characteristic. For the shows that are about romance, right, women and girls have been taught in this country in particular pretty much from birth. I mean, I have a section in the book, a little subhead called Disney from Cradle to Grave, where, you know, media companies like Disney have been teaching women and girls since they were, you know, 2, 3, as early as they can know language, from fairy tales, that the most important day of their life is going to be their wedding, and romance is absolutely the thing that's going to change and improve their life, and if they don't have it, it's not going to be worth living, and no one will value them. And then you know, from after you're 3 or 4 years old, and you've read all the fairy tales, and your parents have taken you to the, you know, Cinderella and Snow White movies, then you graduate to the pre-tween Hannah Montana and all the Disney pop princesses whose, you know, bodies are sexualized even before they're really old enough to understand what that means, and sort of popularity and skinniness and beauty and fame and acclaim all kind of get rolled up into one. And that thing that is rolled up into still says, you know, you've got to be valued by guys and be sort of sexually available, even if it's not for your own pleasure or purpose. And then, you know, it's so lucrative that these media companies don't want to let us grow up. And it's no surprise that ABC is owned by parent company Disney, right? Because The Bachelor and other dating shows infantilize grown women with this idea that all of these misogynistic tropes I talked about before are actually just so romantic. And it's just, you'll hear over and over. The clip in the beginning that you played was kind of innocuous. You know, it wasn't all that that damning. But there are other clips you could play. If you watch it over and over, you start to hear some themes pop up. One of the main themes is, you know, I want my Prince Charming. I want my fairy tale. Every girl wants the fairy tale. And then that fairy tale is defined as, for example, you know, the 23 or 24-year-old bubbly contestant who says, I would be the best wife for Bob because I would be a servant to him. And when he comes home from a long day at work, I would just rub his feet and have dinner waiting for him and just love him. That's a direct quote, by the way, from the past.
You do that a little too well.
I know. I've had to say it a lot. I mean, I have to scrub my brain out every time. But, you know, but that's one of the reasons people tune in, this sort of, like, romantic fantasy. But there are others. I mean, there's the car crash thing. No one's going to deny that. I'm not going to. It's the Schadenfreude. You know that German word that means taking pleasure in other people's pain.
Right.
You can't just turn away from the spectacle. And then there's the other thing. We've been talking a lot about bullying, right?
Mm-hmm.
In our sort of landscape, in our zeitgeist the last year or two. Well, reality TV sort of plays in a almost a safe way for viewers. We feel like we're all of the same emotions that people get when they're bullying others. You know, you laugh at people's pain. You you talk about how stupid they are. You root for some people to win and then the weaker ones to fail. All of those things are the same kinds of things that come out in bullying, but we don't think we're doing it to people we know or who will ever know that we're doing it when we're sitting there on the couch watching them. So it's almost like a safe way to engage in that kind of base behavior.
Well, and there's so much bullying that goes on in the shows. I know
absolutely.
That some of the times when I have been hard up and watched something on The Biggest Loser, I'm always kind of appalled at how those people are treated. I mean, that they would sign up for that. On the one hand, it's supposed to be so empowering and healthy. They're being empowered and given some tools to lose weight. But on the other hand, they are pretty much hazed.
They're hazed. They're mocked. They're degraded. And they're actually not really given tools that are healthy. That's the other thing about reality TV. When you see a reality show, I don't care if it's a weight loss show or a personal rehabilitation show, an addiction show, if a reality series promises to help you rehabilitate your life, run. Because what you're really going to be getting is a whole lot of exploitation. The medical community has denounced The Biggest Loser as being incredibly unhealthy. There was an incredible New York Times expose about, I don't know, a year and a half, 2 years ago, that found some leaked contracts for The Biggest Loser and also talked to anonymous sources who worked on the show who, you know, didn't want to say that they were working on the show or they'd get fired, but talking about the extreme measures that contestants are hazed to the point of, they didn't say the word hazed, but I'm picking up on your word because I think it's apt, to the point where, you know, working out for 6-8 hours a day and then being rated on the scale by the actual numbers encourages people to, say, starve themselves or deny themselves water for 24 hours so that they can get on the scale and lose as much pounds so that they can win that incentive. They have incentive to win the money. Ends up with people in the hospital for liver damage. Ends up with people in the hospital for not just heat exhaustion, but any number of other physical problems. So The Biggest Loser pretends to be about giving people tools, but most people in their day-to-day life don't have the luxury of spending 8 hours a day working out, and even if they did, they shouldn't.
So not exactly a healthy role model.
Not exactly a healthy role model at all. And then, you know, you want to talk about another kind of rehabilitation show on the psychological or sociological end of the spectrum, Flavor of Love Charm School, where women who were systematically and intentionally played for racist stereotypes and degraded on screen regularly by VH1 were then brought back under the guise of benevolent rehabilitation by Monique and VH1 in this show called Charm School, where it opens up with Monique saying to these women, predominantly Black and Latino women, that as the world watched them on Flavor of Love, everybody was laughing. They weren't laughing with them. They were laughing at them because they looked like hookers and they were so, uncouth and they were so skanky and the show was going to help them become, you know, cultured young ladies. And the way they do that? By dressing all of these quote-unquote skanks, who are adult women, right, in fetish Catholic schoolgirl uniforms for the entire time they're on the show, and then giving them lessons about sales and business, which come down to basically spray some perfume on your neck and let men on the street sniff you so they'll buy your perfume, or, lessons about charity means go through the few items you've brought to the house and then give them away to a thrift store. And then depending on how much money the thrift store gives you for your dead mother's wedding ring, then you're, you know, better or worse at charity. It's always about another agenda or another set of texts behind the actual text of the show. So if you hear a show that says, we want to help you and empower you to become, you know, as beautiful as you can be on America's Next Top Model, or to become healthy and live a positive lifestyle and not be addicted on Celebrity Rehab, or to find true love in the perfect fairy tale on The Bachelor, you really need to be looking for the subtext. What is it that they're actually doing versus what is it that they say they're doing? What's the hidden narrative under the producer's stated narrative?
Well, we do have a clip from Charm School, which is one I hadn't heard of before, but let's take a listen to that.
So, Safari, how have you been getting along with the other girls in the house?
Oh, wow. I mean, it's been really great.
So have you punched anyone dead in the face yet?
Oh, girl, no.
So I know you're feeling really proud of your trashy weave, but I gotta tell you, girl, you're looking really ridiculous with them candy apple red tips.
Well, it's not candy apple red, it's pink.
Okay, well, you know what? Yeah, pink.
I can't believe this bitch just said that. She's sitting over there looking like half RuPaul, half Beyonce.
For the people out there in TV land that feel that you look like a man.
I don't believe that that's true. And if they want to believe that, fine.
A clip there from the show we were just discussing with Jennifer Posner. It's from Charm School on VH1. Our guest this hour, Jennifer Posner, Executive Director of Women in Media and News, and the author of Reality Bites Back, The Troubling Truth About Guilty Pleasure TV. And we'd love to hear what you think about reality TV. Do you think it is empowering to the average person? And did you like that you're not necessarily seeing celebrities, you're seeing what may be quote-unquote real people? Or do you think there are poisonous messages within these shows that we should be more aware of? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send your email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Hurts because I need some food. I'm so hungry. I thought I was going to pass out.
I'm very obsessed with my weight, and I'm obsessed about what I eat.
I think that your thighs are a little big for this dress. I'm going to have you walk in it with the zipper open. I think the biggest concern with Kathy for me was the size of her hips. I just want to measure your thighs just to see where we're at.
A clip there from America's Next Top Model. I'm Veronica Rickert with you today on the Ideas Network, and we're joined by Jennifer L. Posner, Executive Director of Women in Media and News, and we're talking about her new book, Reality Bites Back, The Troubling Truth About Guilty Pleasure TV. And America's Top Model is another one that I think you've said is one that hits women especially hard.
Yes, you know, that's one of the most popular reality shows for young girls. At times up to 5 million girls watch that show every week. And it's one of the longest reality show franchises. It's been on since the early 2000s. And consistently over the last decade, this is a show that has aggressively and systemically told gorgeous, gorgeous young women that they're, you know, too fat, too ugly, not good enough, their hair is wrong, especially if they're girls of color, their hair is wrong. And, you know, black and Latina girls regularly have to, are instructed to either shave their heads or use relaxer and weave, because natural black hair is almost never allowed to be considered beautiful on that show, as well as girls with eating disorders. Discussed and cajoled by judges in ways that reinforce those eating disorders. The clip that you just played, a young woman named Cassie, was a bulimic. And she was not a plus-size model. She was a skinny, gorgeous young woman, like all the other skinny, gorgeous young women, except for the every once in a while there's a season with one plus-size woman in the competition. But this was a skinny, gorgeous, you know, when I say gorgeous, I mean classically by the advertising industry's standard, young woman who had an eating disorder and was edited on screen to be basically almost everything you saw about her in terms of fashion designers dealing with her, judges talking to her, etc., dealt with people telling her she wasn't good enough, she was too heavy, etc. And she would respond by saying basically that that's yet more reason why she has to starve herself or throw up after she eats. And then she would be very defensive. I'm not bulimic. I just throw up sometimes. And that was supposed to be our little moment for the viewers about why it's not good to have an eating disorder. In another season, a girl who was a recovering anorexic, who was very vocal about being a recovering anorexic, specifically said, had started to eat healthily again. And so during the filming, she was a high school, I think she was a high school grad, so she was very young. During the filming, she started to gain a couple pounds, very, very minimal. But it was a little tiny bit visible when you're in, you know, bikinis and modeling lingerie and such. You see every ounce. And the judges basically yelled at her for letting herself go and for not treating her body like a temple. We did not get to see in those scenes any discussion of her, the fact that she was a recovering anorexic and she was finally being healthy. Instead, all we saw was girl gains weight, girl gets yelled at. Of course, newsflash, how do you treat your body like a temple? You feed it, right? But a show like Top Model has been so unhealthy for so long about body image and size and about images of race and beauty, despite Tyra Banks' stated narrative about how she wants to help young girls of color expand the definition of beauty. Very often, the images on the show and the comments from judges are contrary to that.
Well, I want to go to our callers next. We've got a lot of people waiting to talk to you, and start with Andy in Lake Geneva. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Veronica. Well, you know, this stuff is going in variety decadence. In the modern age, effectively, and you see it more clearly when you look from a historical perspective. At some point, all empires in their life cycle, this being an American empire, they hit a point where decadence really begins to gallop forward and really begins to take over. And there's nothing. When you take a look at the empires of the past, starting with the Roman, the French, the Venetian, you can see absolute parallels. I mean, whether it be the old Roman amphitheater, where the up and the down vote, the Venetians with all their plays and all their pornography and the like, and the French. So what we're witnessing here is modern decadence that has taken different forms and different structures in historical past, but nothing's new. It just shows what happens when an empire really begins to hit the proverbial wall, and this begins to just plunge forward all over the place. That's effectively what we're dealing with here.
So it's a sign of the fall. What do you think about that, Jennifer?
I could see sort of a... It might be tempting to make that kind of one-to-one comparison, but I think that lets, to some degree, the very calculated nature of a very specific TV subgenre off the hook. Right? This is not some sort of mark of progress or regress in terms of it happening at like the weather or something. This is media networks and advertisers collaborating to create a new genre in which product placement advertising would be just as much a star of any given series as the people on the shows. Plus a genre in which all of the writers, because there are writers on every reality show, as well as all of the crew and the staff, would be on non-union. So this is why reality TV exists, not as the networks and producers claim to be just something about public demand. Oh, we're just giving the public what they want. It's not a supply and demand thing. That's a myth. The reality is that reality television is 50 to 75% cheaper to produce than scripted TV. And after that massive reduction in cost, it generates hundreds of thousands of dollars, sometimes millions of dollars, from product placement advertisers before they ever sell a traditional commercial. And that gives product placement advertisers unprecedented access to the production process, having influence over who gets cast and who gets excluded, how story arcs get created, what gets said, what people believe based on the shows. And so this is, I would say, much more than sort of some sort of inevitable empire destruction thing. This is much more about corporate media and about media consolidation. This has much more to do historically with the Telecommunications Act of 1996 than it does with the fall of Rome.
Well, I will say this. I am right now, I'm reading The Hunger Games, which is this young adult series. Have you read it?
I've read the first, yes.
Right, so I'm on the first one. And basically the setup, and I'm not giving anything away here, is that this is a dystopian future in which teenagers are culled from different outlying districts and they're made to kill each other in an arena on a giant reality TV show.
Mm-hmm.
And having gone from that to reading your book and the issues you discuss there, it raises some uncomfortable questions to me about just what are we able to watch? What are we allowing ourselves to watch, and why, and how far does it go?
I think that is so astute. It's funny, Kansas State University brought me to speak last year. They had assigned that first book of The Hunger Games to their incoming students as a book that everybody would read, and then they would have all sorts of events on campus related to it. And then I was one of the people they brought in to have an event around reality TV and what are we actually watching and what are we actually sort of digging into in this genre? What does it tell us about ourselves? And I think that one of the things that we learn from juxtaposing The Hunger Games with reality shows, let's go back to Top Model for a minute. In The Hunger Games, the reality TV show concept is that an entire sort of one-world nation of people who are vastly poor except for the uber-elite rich. So I guess sort of the ultimate 99% occupy versus 1% of ruling class are basically subject to losing their young people every year in this, you know, death to the finish reality show. Well, let's look at America's Next Top Model, which on many seasons has instructed the girls to pose as if they're dead and yet still very glamorous in numerous different scenes. I think the worst one was an episode that I like to refer to as the Beautiful Corpses episode. It was actually a homicide victim challenge where all of the women had to pose as if they'd been brutally murdered. One of them was shot in the head, and there's blood everywhere. Somebody else was stabbed in the chest. Somebody else has been pushed off of a roof, and she's, you know, dangling limp and on the cold concrete of the, way below. And someone's electrocuted in the bathtub. And then the judges the entire time are saying things like, "You look gorgeous dead," and "Oh, death becomes you, young lady," or no, you need to move your arm. We need you to look like you were brutally murdered, not like you were just sleeping.
That's worse than I thought.
Yeah,
I had no idea.
It really is. It really is. And we're supposed to think that this is gorgeous. And young girls, the thing is, you asked in the very beginning, don't we all know it's real? We all are not a monolith, right? There are educated people who watch reality TV just as much as there are uneducated people who watch reality TV, and there are people who are, watching it because they like to make fun of it, and there are people who watch it because they feel like they can relate to it. But then there are also many, many millions of young people who have grown up with reality TV. So, you know, we're not talking only about 35 or 65-year-old people who have media literacy skills. We're talking a lot of the time about 5-year-olds and 10-year-olds and 15-year-olds who do not have as many or maybe any media literacy skills to be able to decipher this kind of thing in a critical way. And in fact, the Girl Scouts did a recent survey of 1,000 girls, and they found that young women who regularly watch reality TV are more likely than people who don't to, quote, accept and expect a higher level of drama, aggression, and bullying in their lives. Mm-hmm. And they also tend to be more likely to believe that it's in a girl's nature to be catty and competitive with one another, that it's hard for them to trust other girls, and that girls have to compete for men's attention.
Wow. So that's pretty troubling in terms of whether or not, I mean, especially when you look at children, obviously they're not going to have the sophisticated filters and critical thinking skills yet to be able to parse some of this stuff. Well, let's
that's
go back.
Why this, so crucial to teach media literacy in school. And I have in the book, Reality Bites Back, I turn over the last chapter of the book, even though it's an analysis book, I opened it to scholars, media activists, and media analysts, and I asked them, what would you do, what would you tell people to do to transform the media for the better? And one of my colleagues, Andrea Quijada from the Media Literacy Project in New Mexico, gave a really great 10-step plan for how parents and other concerned people can get K through 12 schools to adopt media literacy education.
Well, let's come back and take another phone call. We've got Sam joining us from Madison. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Veronica. Good morning, and good morning to Jennifer as well.
Morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I think Veronica sort of stole my question in one of her previous comments, but here's what I wanted to say. In the beginning of the show, you mentioned that these shows have become very mainstream and predominant. And I think one of the reasons for that is that these shows are very cheap to produce, and the return on these shows is very good. So I think that this predominance of mainstreamness may be very artificial. And I like to compare these shows to actually fast food, wherein the food is very cheap to produce, and it provides you, you know, instant gratification or cheap satisfaction. But in the end, it's actually really bad for you. And I think that is the economics of the shows that I think is also very important to consider why they are so prevalent and why they're so mainstream.
Thank you, Sam. Jennifer?
Sam's absolutely right. I think that my editor at Seal Press would very much agree with Sam. She was a big fan of the book Fast Food Nation, and when she first approached me about my book, she said that one of the reasons that she liked the idea of Seal doing this book is because she sees my point about reality TV being to sort of the American psyche, what Fast Food Nation talked about food being to the American sort of health and nutritional standards. And I think he's right, and I think the only other point I want to add, I'd love to get some more questions, so I'll keep this part short, but it's not just that reality TV is cheap, it's that it is so cheap that when reality shows do poorly in the ratings, they very often get to stay on air for multiple seasons, even longer than scripted shows that often do better with higher ratings and get canceled. That is the other myth I want to debunk right here today. This, I said before that, you know, I want to debunk the myth that this is just what the public wants. The other myth is that, oh, if the ratings weren't there, we wouldn't have these shows. If people voted with their remotes, they would just give us something else. And the networks say this all the time. It's not true, because reality shows sometimes do great. I mean, look, American Idol, single most popular TV show other than sports broadcasts of the entire decade. But most reality shows do not get those kinds of ratings, and even the ones that get terrible ratings stay on the air sometimes for years. There was a show called The Pickup Artist on, now I can't remember if it was VH1 or MTV, but they're all both owned by Viacom. I get them confused because they have a very similar programming. But The Pickup Artist was just about the premise of some sort of calculating, scheming dude who was going to teach schlubby losers how to transform into players who could, you know, get any woman's number and get any woman into bed by manipulating them and deriding their self-esteem. And it did poorly, very poorly. It never got more than, a few hundred thousand viewers. I don't remember the exact number, but it was terrible, basically. Didn't do well, even with the prioritized 18 to 34-year-old male demographic that they were going for, never got past about a 1-point-something in the rating for that demo. And it got a second season anyway, because these shows are so cheap, come with so much product placement money, and you don't have to pay the major cast, major crew, or union writers. So it doesn't matter if viewers don't watch sometimes. They've already made their money.
Are there shows that you consider higher up on the food chain, ones that you don't have to feel quite as icky about watching?
Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, I don't want to be Ms. Doom and Gloom here. There are some reality shows that are less damaging, and some that are a few, not many, in the hundreds and hundreds. I wouldn't say that there are many that are positive, but there are some that are positive, or at least have positive elements. So, for example, The Amazing Race, which I think has been right to win so many Emmys. Though it's sad that reality shows have an Emmy category now. The Amazing Race seems to intentionally cast for diversity for the sake of diversity, not for the sake of mocking people based on race or gender or sexuality. When they cast gay, lesbian, and bisexual people, they do so not in a very special episode of kind of way, and not to make them stand out as you know, kind of flaming queen stereotypes or unapproachable cold lesbian stereotypes. They cast gay and lesbian and bisexual people as average people going through the race, which is a wonderful visibility thing, and even more importantly, they bring in an era of media consolidation where journalism has been cut to bare bones, and where it's easier to find breaking headlines about, you know, Lindsay Lohan going back to jail or coming out of jail or going back to jail or going out of jail, or, you know, Paris Hilton wearing or not wearing panties on CNN, right? It's harder to find investigative reporting about what's going on abroad, overseas. And the only time we see that is usually if there's some, you know, violent revolution happening or some, American war going on. The Amazing Race brings cultures from all around the world that we never even see on the news into the living rooms of average Americans. And that has some educational value. Now, of course, the way they do that is often co-opting and often reductive and sometimes doesn't allow the local people from local regions to speak for themselves about their culture. So it's not perfect at all by any means. But even if it's a little bit colonialization oriented in the way they're talking about different regions, at least it offers viewers a glimpse into life outside of America and what that might be like, and doesn't treat the people in the race as regressive fools.
Well, let's get to one more phone call before our break. We have Bill joining us next from Madison. Hi, Bill.
Hello. I'd like to react to a couple of things that the guest has said. I'd like to mention that earlier in my life, I worked in a job where most everyone there except me was 20-something female. And I overheard... Basically, I was the fly on the wall in a lot of break room conversations. And I can tell you that people, cattiness, manipulation, the nastiness that you see in things like The Bachelor, whatever, believe me, there are women like this. And I used to work with them. I worked with them for like 5 years. And individually, these women were often quite decent. But in a group, it got ugly. And
so you're saying reality?
Can I finish?
Okay.
The idea that these aren't real people, I think, is misleading. These are the part that I find so depressing about these shows is that I think to myself, oh my God, there are millions more just like these folks. But on the other side, there is one reality show that I kind of like, and there's it's called American Pickers. I think it's on A&E. And it shows people doing what they love, treating each other with respect, treating the people that they meet with dignity, and they're having a lot of fun. And basically, at the end of the show, you sort of feel a little better about the human condition. But that's the one exception I found.
What is that one about? What's the premise?
Well, basically, it's a couple of guys who are based in Iowa, and they go all around the American countryside. Looking at, they want to find antiques, pieces of history that they can turn around and sell. And they'll find a barn find. They'll find a 48 Hudson sitting in a barn for 40 years, and they'll buy it off some guy. Or they'll find some, basically they're just looking for pieces of Americana, pieces of history, pieces of, of antiques, and they buy and sell. And they basically look like in the American Midwest, if you go on the back roads, there's just tons of these people, you know, that just have barns full of stuff.
Yeah, they have a version of this show, of that same show on, I believe, TLC. If it's not TLC, it's Oxygen. There's a version of that show with two women who do the same thing. And you're right, that it's not every reality show that's exploitative. The lifestyle shows, like The Real Housewives, tend to be most exploitative. The competition shows and the dating shows tend to be most exploitative. But when you have shows on A&E or TLC that focus on a couple of people doing a specific job, often that kind of subgenre is less exploitative because it's focused on sort of the art and practice of a particular skill. And I think you're right that those tend to be more fun and less about, you know, human catastrophe and less about the Schadenfreude aspect of watching. They tend to mock people less. But I do think that it's important to address your first point that, you know, saying that, you know, there are, you know, first of all, sorry you had to work with people who were manipulative or problematic, because it sounds like you didn't have a really fun time at work at that period of time. But I think that what's interesting is this goes back to an earlier question we were talking about, is don't we all know that this stuff isn't real? We don't all know that this stuff isn't real. We might relate to some of the extremely regressive and extremely calculated, very specific stereotypes that happen over and over on reality TV for 10, 12 years now, to, you know, one or two examples of people we might have met once or dealt with at some point in our lives. And then we extrapolate that to, oh, if that's, you know, if the one or two people I met who act this way are reflected in every single thing we're seeing on The Bachelor and The Flavor of Love and The Real Housewives and The Bad Girls Club and Top Model and et cetera ad nauseum, then that must just be what American women are like. Except that's a fallacy, right? Because these shows are not just manipulated in the editing process. They start with casting. Producers and casting directors look very specifically for people who they believe will behave certain ways, or who they believe they can edit into playing certain kinds of roles. And then those roles get rehashed over and over and over again until the end of reality TV time, where we don't see much diversity of humanity, right? If reality TV was, as networks say, just a reflection of who we are as Americans at this time in our culture, then you'd see people who were smart and dumb, hilarious and dull, you know, have a lot of integrity and are, you know, and some are manipulative. Some want to get married and some want to stay single. Some are amazing parents and some want to remain childless for life. You would see the wide range of human experience. Instead, you see a very specifically regressive 1950s model of what it means to be an American. So in that model, women only want to get married, and if they don't, they're going to be losers and desperate, sad people for the rest of their lives. That women's main value is their beauty and their bodies. Their only power comes through that, or primary power comes through that. That people of color exist primarily to be seen as buffoons and clowns or thugs and uneducated, violent fools. And that women of color exist to be seen as hypersexual and quote-unquote ghetto. These are all very regressive ideas about what it means to be American, and they don't reflect who we are as a broad culture today. They reflect outmoded stereotypes that reality TV is working to resurrect.
Well, we're talking this hour with Jennifer Posner. She is a media critic and executive director of Women in Media and News. And we're talking about her book. It's called Reality Bites Back: The Troubling Truth About Guilty Pleasure TV. And we're interested to hear what you have to say about it. Do you think that reality TV is empowering? Are we making maybe too much of some of the negative aspects of it? What do you think? Our number, 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. I'm Veronica Rickard, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickard back with you this Friday on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And coming up at 1 o'clock today, join us for Talk of the Nation Science Friday as Ira Flatow has a conversation with Dr. Andrew Weil about alternatives to antidepressants like practicing meditation. That's 1 o'clock's Talk of the Nation Science Friday. Right now, we're talking to Jennifer Posner. She's Executive Director of Women in Media and News and the author of the book Reality Bites Back, The Troubling Truth About Guilty Pleasure TV. And Jennifer, one thing I wanted to bring up was that as we talk about all this, it's tempting to think about this as an American phenomenon, but reality TV is a global phenomenon. A lot of the reality TV shows that have hit it big here, well, they started in Britain, and I know that they're importing a lot of them to places, you know, like Russia now. What do you think about the global spread of reality TV?
Well, I think that you're absolutely right. Reality TV didn't start here, and we keep importing a lot of the and redoing a lot of the shows that you see on TV here are in some version have appeared elsewhere, Big Brother, that sort of thing. But once reality TV hit the American primetime network landscape in 2000, it became a very, very different thing. And now we are exporting reality shows all around the world in massive numbers to the point where I'm seeing American reality TV as a version of sort of contemporary cultural imperialism. And that sounds, you know, kind of academic, and it sounds almost a little scary. But what I really mean is there are many ways in which people all around the world are learning about who they believe Americans are from reality TV shows. And that itself is extremely troubling. In fact, I have a journalist friend from Iraq, and she said that a few years ago, as American bombs are falling in Iraq, her cousins are watching America's Next Top Model. And so the entire, you know, there are regions in the world where the main idea about who Americans are is, you know, on the one hand, you know, warmongers and people who don't understand the rest of the world as witnessed by our cable news. And then they turn to entertainment and they see what is being represented as real life in America, and women just scream at each other and throw tables over and curse and hook up with people they don't even like and, you know, care only about money. And it's an extremely troubling and limiting and unflattering image of who Americans are.
Well, let's get one more call in before the end of the hour. Andre is joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Andre.
Hello. Good morning.
Morning.
I'm just calling in because I have a comment, but I really don't watch reality TV at all. And the only time that I've ever seen any parts of the shows was turning the channels to find something else that I was interested in. I think that reality TV is warping the minds of the American family. Families don't sit down at the dinner table and discuss the issues of the day, discuss their kids' schooling or grades. They all crowd around a TV carrying their dinner plates into the family room or the living room to watch this garbage on TV that makes no sense. You've got people at work emailing, Gmailing, and texting each other. Kids in school, not even interested in schoolwork. They're interested in America's Next Top Model, that doggone show where everybody sings. Nobody in the family is talking about the issues that are important. You don't know if your teenage daughter is sexually active. You don't know if she's dating somebody that you don't like. You don't know if your son is on drugs. You don't know if he's in a gang, because you're not talking about family issues anymore.
Thank you, Andre.
I'm
gonna
stupid show.
I'm gonna toss it over to Jennifer so we can get her response before the end of the hour. And also, Jennifer, when you finish responding to Andre, what can we do about it?
I'm so glad you asked that. I'll mention just very quickly to Andre, I think that you're right. I don't necessarily think that reality TV is to blame for that. I think that there's a, you know, we need to be looking at economics a lot, about when people are working two and three jobs, a lot of the time we don't have time for the traditional, you know, sit around the family dinner at 7 o'clock thing anymore. And there are a lot of different intersecting reasons why we don't have as much communication. But I think that it would be really great if, rather than deciding, you know, as a huge mass that all of a sudden we're going to tell our kids they can't watch TV. Instead, wouldn't it be great if we could use whatever they're engaged with, whether that's reality TV or the latest Twilight film or who knows what in media or their favorite video game, and watch that with them, engage with them, and help them to become more critical and more active in their viewership, more intellectually savvy about what they're engaging in, because media literacy is our most powerful weapon against propaganda and manipulation in today's media-saturated culture. So to answer you, one of the things that we can do about this is...
And we're just about out of time, Jennifer. I'm so sorry, but I'll direct people to your website, womenonline.org, to get more ideas, WIMNonline.org. And Jennifer, thank you.
And realitybitesbackbook.com has a Fun with Media Literacy section.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and Chrissy Pease for taking your calls. I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.